Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to another edition of the Talking Metal Podcast, home of all things hard rock and heavy metal. I'm Mark Striegel, host and producer of this show since 2005. Now, let's get things started with the Talking Metal theme song, written by Rob Halford, Metal Mike, and Roy Z.
Hey guys, welcome to another edition of Talking Metal. Today's guest is Bob Nalbandian. He's going to tell us all about his great new film, Inside Metal. It's the second edition, I guess I'd call it, of the Inside Metal series, and it's all about the early LA scene. So stay tuned for that. Please keep using those Amazon links on talkingmetal.com. Call us, leave us a message on our hotline. That number is 973-757-1917. Again, 973-757-1917. Please leave us a review on iTunes. A positive one is preferred. And use the PayPal tab on our site to make a donation. We're currently sold out of t-shirts. Hopefully we'll be getting those back in real soon. Follow me on Twitter at Talking Metal and at Striegel. Follow Talking Metal's Instagram page. I'm on Snapchat at Captain T-Head is the name. That's CaptainTeahead. And again, use those Amazon links. I appreciate that. Guys, check out the site. It's TalkingMetal.com. All right, we got Mitch LaFon's show up there. This show, of course, Talking Rock and Metal Raps, all on the Talking Metal website, TalkingMetal.com. Thanks, guys. Here is a little Can You Deliver by Armored Saint. And we'll end today's show with the song Hold On to 18 by Black and Blue. That's what you'll hear after my long discussion with the great Bob Nalbandian. Here we go.
Can you deliver? Come on, look at you. Laying out the question. Do you know what love means? A person fills you. Don't put the thought around me. I'm coming from above. Time tonight. Yeah.
Hey guys, there is a great new movie out that I highly recommend you check out, Inside Metal. It's a documentary, The LA Metal Scene Explodes 2, and we have the mastermind behind this film with us here on the show today, Bob Nalbandian. How are you, Bob?
I'm good. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. Last time you were on, I got a lot of great comments, so I'm glad you're back, and I'm glad we can talk specifically about the LA metal scene, which, you know, as a kid, I went to high school in the Chicago suburbs, and, you know, like so many people in the 80s, loved heavy metal and learned to play guitar, and I never made it there, but because my parents basically stopped me. But, you know, everyone in our little band at high school were like, well, when we graduate high school, we have to go to LA. We have to get there because that's where it's happening. And you know, this documentary that you put together really takes me back to that time because it absolutely, without a question, is where it happened. So first off, you did part one of this, I guess I would call it, Inside Metal.
Correct.
And we spoke to you back when that came out. I don't know what that was, a year ago or so. And now this era specifically, what time frame are we talking about here?
This would be roughly 1982 to 1986. So it basically takes off where the Pioneers of LA Metal, which was the first title, Pioneers of LA Hard Rock and Metal, it basically takes off where that left off. And, you know, we call it the LA metal scene explodes because this is truly when the original LA metal scene exploded. I mean, of course, you had specific bands like Van Halen in the 70s and whatever. But the big explosion that everyone remembers was, you know, of course, when Motley Crue and Quiet Riot and all these bands, Rat, Armored Right. Saint, Black and Blue, they were all getting signed by major labels, Wasp, of course, Rough Cut, Malice, Warrior. I could go on and on. You know, it was a big surge. And, it, you know, it was the beginning of MTV. It was a lot of hype. You know, the US Vessel came around and during that time in 83. So there was a lot of hype surrounding, you know, not just metal, but hard rock, and particularly in the Los Angeles area.
Yeah. And what, you know, what you mentioned there was so many big things just kind of coming together, like, you know, MTV, US Festival. All, it was like just the moment in time where all these kind of things kind of contributed to this LA metal scene and just blew it up.
Yeah. It was perfect timing, really, with MTV and everything else. And I think the live feel, I think really too, the new wave of British heavy metal, all that was going on overseas with, you know, Maiden, Saxon, Motorhead, that was making its way to the shores of LA. And, you know, there were a lot of real heavy, kind of more European influence LA bands around that time. But of course, people always think of LA as the glam bands, which really, I mean, you had, you know, Motley Crue and Rat, but even those bands were a bit heavier when they started and when they were playing Absolutely. The clubs, Steeler and bands like that. And I think most people kind of remember the second wave, which was like, you know, the Poison, Slaughter, Faster Pussycat, Warrant, that kind of thing. But right. You know, and initially it was pretty underground. It was very underground. I mean, the bands really busted their ass, and it was a working class metal. You know, you did have some bands that kind of obviously glammed it up. You know, they took after more the New York Dolls in the early 70s kind of glam scene.
Maybe right, as far as their look goes, right?
Yeah, exactly. And sound a little bit, you know, they were a little, I mean, you know, you listen to the first Motley Crue album, that's very poppy. And, you know, certainly Rat and other bands had that pop element. But, you know, we also wanted to concentrate on a lot of the bands. You know, Warrior, which was my co-producer, Joe Floyd. I know you played songs off the Fighting for the Earth album on Talk Metal, a great album, underground, but they had a huge buzz. Malice was another band that were very European, very Judas Priest influence. And of course, you know, Metallica were still in LA at that time, Megadeth. And, you know, we don't get into Slayer into this because we have a separate one coming out next called The Rise of LA Thrash cool. Metal, where we concentrate more on the thrash scene, which we could talk about in a bit. But
yeah,
this was really a situation where the LA metal scene was just thriving, and the club scene, even before they were getting the radio support and, you know, before Rad and Motley released their debut or independent EPs or albums, they were selling out, you know, the Troubadour and even the Country Club and all these venues. And it was just this real underground metal surge. And it was a great time, Mark. It was really something special.
Well, I want to talk to you more about that time. But before we do, let's just talk about the production of this. First off, obviously, dozens and dozens of great interviews. But I have to say, I really enjoyed the first one, the first Inside Metal one. But I do enjoy this one more. And it's not only because I relate more to the bands. I think it's more my era of stuff. But I don't know. I felt like the flow of it kind of was the production, the flow, the editing is really, really tight and well done. And I love how you hit a topic and you hear from so many different people on the one topic, then it moves to the next topic. What I'm saying is it's really well put together. Who edited it with you?
Well, yeah, I got to give major props to Rico Lari. He was the actual main editor. Ed did the initial edits, Carl Alvarez, and he kind of like helped sequence it. But, you know, as far as adding in all the music, getting all the rough edges out and getting the flow of it and adding in the narration that John Bush did and editing everything together and all the photos and the videos and all that stuff. That was Rico Lari, and he did a fantastic job. And he's, we were really happy to use him. On the first one, we used actually two editors, Carl helped on that as well, but we used Robert Gaston and Curtis Don Vito, who's also the singer of the band Snoo. So I do want to give them credit for the first one. And the good thing about Rico, I mean, on the first one, and you know, I'm not putting blame on anyone, because myself too, we were all amateurs when we started. I didn't know about filmmaking, and Joe Floyd, who I initially started the project with, he didn't know about, you know, filming or anything. He was an audio producer. He produced a lot of stuff at SoundCloud Studios with you know, he did a lot of the Jakey Lee stuff and a lot of bands, LA bands. So he was familiar with that end, but not really the visuals. So we all kind of came into it. So yeah, I do agree with you. The first one, there was a lot of experimentation because we were so new to this, and the sequencing and, you know, the flow wasn't quite right on certain things. I think on the second one, you know, especially Carl and I, because he was the one that really helped me sequence it, and he's the one that really had that eye for it. It was just a great team for everyone to put together. And I think the relationship with Carl and I really built so much better on this second one, that we kind of both saw where, where to go about with this movie, you know, the mistakes we made on the first one. And the great thing about Rico is he's a pro editor. You know, a lot of stuff I wasn't familiar with, like QC, you know, quality control. Right. And
sure.
When editing, it's especially to get on even iTunes and a lot of the digital outlets. You know, they sent back a QC sheet with all these things that needed to be fixed if we were going to go on it, you know. And Warren, the executive producer, was like pulling his hair out. And, you know, so, you know, the first one, we did have a lot of issues. And it was, you know, because we were all kind of amateurs. And even, you know, Joe filming and everything, there were certain edits that weren't covered up good enough or whatever, so a couple sound bites that. So, you know, we kind of learned from that, and it was great with Rico because he's very, very familiar with QC. He's edited a lot of major pictures. So, yeah, I agree. The editing is much sharper, and I think it's a lot cleaner.
Yeah, and there's great storytelling. I mean, there's a real story that's told here. Again, guys, we're talking about Inside Metal. The LA metal scene explodes, too. And it's out on DVD. Where, if somebody wanted to buy it on DVD, where would they go, Bob?
Well, we got it actually as a discount at the metalrockfilms.com website. That's the company that put it out. Warren Croyle, as I mentioned, the executive producer and the head of Metal Rock. He's actually got a sale. If you buy the two volumes, again, this is kind of confusing. People think this is the third movie or fourth movie because it's two volumes of each DVD. So the Pioneers was a two DVD set sold separately, and so is this one. But yeah, you could get it through Metal Rock Films. And if you buy the DVDs, Warren's going to also throw in another DVD from another great director and producer, a movie called Metal Messiah. I don't know if he sent that one to you as well.
He did. I didn't have a chance yet to watch that, but he did.
It's a fun movie. It's like a total rock and roll spoof, kind of like a Spinal Tap meets, the Stone Age or something,
Right.
But you could go through metalrockfilms.com, although he is only accepting PayPal through that. Otherwise, the best and most popular one, of course, Amazon. Yeah. They've got both DVDs. And if they do, if it says they're out of stock, they get it in stock within the next couple of days. So don't let that deter you from ordering it through Amazon. And a lot of the local record stores, I've noticed, have carry it too,
cool.
Which is great. And we really urge people to go out to the record stores and support the local record stores. So, and then digitally, it's on Amazon Prime.
That's where I watched it. Yep.
Yeah. It's really cool to watch on that, and a very great outlet, which a lot of people have. Of course, it's on iTunes as well. I believe part two, there was some kind of confusion. Part two is coming out on iTunes, I believe, in December.
Okay.
They kind of separated that there, and it's also on Google Play. And as I said, it's going to be going to cable pay-per-view on several of the digital channels. So you can check the guide to see. And that should be going next month as well.
Cool. Well, let's talk about some of the more – I don't want to give all the stories away. I don't want to give away everything that happens in the documentary. But a few topics I did want to hit upon. Number one, I thought it was really interesting because when you hear about L.A. metal – you think of the Rats, the Motley Crue and Poison and, Leatherwolf and all these bands like that. But a lot of people don't think of Ozzy Osbourne as part of the L.A. metal scene, a guy from Birmingham, England, Sabbath. But he really was a part of the L.A. metal scene, and in a lot of ways helped it blossom. And you could do an excellent job of painting that story in the documentary. Can you talk a little bit about how Ozzy was directly involved with the LA metal scene?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you bring that up, because a lot of people say, oh, you have Ozzy. Ozzy's not from LA. He's from England. It's like, dude, I know that. But, obviously when Blizzard of Oz came out, they based themselves in England. The original band, everyone knows, Randy Rhoads, of course, was in the original Quiet Riot. And we cover them extensively in the Pioneers of LA Hard Rock and Metal. And they based themselves, with Bob Daisley and Lee Kerslake here in LA. And since then, Ozzy always got all his musicians from the LA area or San Diego, like Jakey Lee and, all the musicians pretty much that followed, from Mike Inez to Phil Soussan. And they were pretty much, Ozzy really was pretty much an LA band.
Even going back to Rudy Sarzo,
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I forgot Rudy Sarzo, of course, and Tommy Aldridge, although I don't think Tommy was from L.A., but, he always got U.S. Players. And, of course, after Dio's first lineup, he got a lot of, American players as well. He was real tight with Rough Cutt. So L.A., as I think David Ellison kind of says, L.A. really was the hub of, the epicenter of the metal scene. Yngwie, obviously, we all know he's from Sweden. He started out with the L.A. band Steeler when he came when he was 19. So Yngwie really broke in Los Angeles. And, I think that's important for people to know. So many bands, even Lemmy, he based himself in the early 80s, right behind the Rainbow, as everyone knows. And he was a big fixture of the LA scene, although, obviously everyone knows Motorhead is the British metal band, but so many bands kind of based themselves in LA and they were part of the scene. And that's really what we talk about, and then, of course, you got so many bands that latter came over, from the Poisons to everyone else, even Steeler, they came over from Nashville. So, a lot of bands came out to L.A. and became L.A. bands and a part of the scene. And that's really, really what we wanted to get at in this.
Yeah. And so you had some of the more like established rock stars coming there to form bands, pull musicians, guys like Ozzy Osbourne and Ronnie James Dio. But then, like you just mentioned, you had this this influx, I guess would be the word, of bands from all over the country, just literally flocking there. And one thing you touch upon in the movie is just the culture shock that these bands would have. Can you talk a little bit about that and what it was like for a band coming from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, or, you know, Alaska for that matter, to end up in Hollywood in like 1984?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the bands kind of describe it good. You mentioned Alaska, the band Pandemonium. They came from Alaska, and it, you know, they talk about how it was just a major culture shock for them coming from a small town in Alaska, and they built themselves up really quickly. They were, again, one of those bands that were selling out the Country Club and the Troubadour. If you're talking 81, 82, they were probably one of the biggest drawing LA bands. And then, of course, you had all the neighboring cities, Orange County, Leatherwolf were huge in Orange County. And then they built up in LA. You know, they were out headlining the Country Club, and they were drawing the same amount of people as, you know, the Poisons and all these other bands that started, yet they were kind of forgotten about. So, so many of these bands did come from all over. As I mentioned, Steeler, they came from Nashville. And based themselves rather quickly in LA. And of course, Rat and Warrior, and there was a band called Sarge. They came up from the San Diego area. So everyone kind of knew LA was the place, even before MTV hit big, because we're talking, this is before there was a real scene. I mean, people remember from Van Halen, and people always read about the LA clubs and the whiskey, and that was always, even, you know, going back to the 60s and 70s, that was the place where most artists broke. And, you know, the Doors and all these bands would, you know, Zeppelin and Alice Cooper, they would play the whiskey in all these clubs. So I think people knew that, and people knew that there was a scene and a vibe on the Strip with the Rainbow and the Whiskey and Gazzari's back in the day, and of course the Roxy. All those clubs were booming, and the Strip was just crazy. And, you know, by 81, the Starwood had closed, so it was like the Troubadour kind of took over. The Troubadour was a major metal mecca, you know, Wasp, Hellion, you know, Abattoir, all these bands would be playing, you know, and White Sister and Great White and Rat and all these bands, Armored Saint, they would headline maybe two nights at the Troubadour on a Friday and Saturday. And, you know, they ended up, you know, there's a story in the movie where they took out the tables because that an Armored Saint show, the people just went nuts, you know, on the floor. They used to be a dinner theater, you know, and that was kind of what, and all those clubs were, the Whiskey, Roxy, they were dinner theaters. So at that point, they realize, hey, this metal scene, not only musically but fan wise, there's an energy here. You know, this isn't the kind of thing where you're going to sit down and have dinner and drinks. You know, you're going to, you know, headbang and go crazy. So it was kind of a whole change, you know, in that era.
How personally were you involved with the scene back in the day? When did you first realize what was going on? How much of it did you experience?
You know, Mark, I grew up in Huntington Beach, which is about an hour south in Orange County. So I used to go to a club, and we talk about it quite a bit because it was really people forget about Orange County really gave a lot of notoriety to especially the heavier bands. Metallica did their first shows at the Woodstock and Radio City and the Concert Factory. Same with Slayer. You know, that was their home turf. You know, they were always playing in Orange County and hall parties in Southgate and around that area. And there was a band called August Red Moon who we interview who were like the Orange County Motley Crue. And then you would, of course, have bands like, you know, Snow and Rat and all these bands. Motley Crue would come out and play Radio City and the Woodstock and Sound Barrier, who were the fantastic all black rock metal band. I remember one of the first shows I saw at the Radio City was Motley Crue, Rat, and Sound Barrier.
Wow.
And yeah, what year was that? This was just before the Too Fast for Love album came out. They had the single. I remember they were selling the single of Stick to Your Guns. Yeah. Right. So, it was just great. And the places were packed. And there was a band called A La Carte, who we talked about extensively, and the pioneers of L.A. hard rock and metal. They were a little bit before, but they were like the first band I saw at a place called the Golden Bear, which was a fantastic old school venue. And, of course, Hendrix and the Doors and all these bands used to play the Golden Bear right on PCH in Huntington Beach, which is no longer. So, you know, I started out, that was kind of my scene. And again, Leather Wolf were another band that were in the LA area. Of course, Dante Fox, who became Great White, they were playing the Woodstock and Radio City all the time. So you didn't even have to leave Orange County, really. LA scene was so booming, and they had even just great club blues artists. I remember there was an artist called Walter Trout, who's a blues guitar player who's very huge in Europe, but he would play little Huntington Beach club called Perks, and we, all the rockers, would go there, and because he was just this amazing blues guitar player, and it was just a really, really cool scene. And then I kind of made my way out to the Troubadour, and Armored Saint was my band in LA. I saw them from the beginning, and of course, as you know, John Bush did the narration, and I was very privileged to have John do it. He was very happy to do it. I wasn't really happy with the way I did the narration on the first movie. And I know John does professionally, he does a lot of voiceover work. And yeah, he's such a great, not only a great singer, but just he's got that great voice.
He did the Burger King commercials for a number of years and just made a killing at it, from what I understand.
Yeah, he's done very well. He and his wife have a very successful casting agency. So John is great. I just saw them last week. They play. I mean, I'm in Sacramento now, and Armored Saint just played up here with Queensryche, and I got to hang with them. And it was just really cool. But yeah, L.A., you know, the country club was the place. I mean, that's where all the major bands would first come over, when Yngwie came with Steeler, and then you would have like Merciful Fate and Accept and all these Motorhead. When MSG first came over, they would play. So you'd get national acts, because it was about, you know, 800 to 1,000 seat venue. That was a great venue. So you, if you played the country club, that was like the high level of being a club band. And then the next step up would be Perkins Palace, which Gina Zambarelli did in Pasadena. And she has some of the greatest bills, you know, Wasp, Rat, and Armored Saint, Great White, and, you know, Steeler and Rat, and, you know, Stormer, and always killer bills at the Perkins Palace, and that was about a 1,200 to 1,500 seat venue. So we would go to those all the time. They had a Thursday night heavy metal night at the country club, and you'd have Armored Saint playing, or you know, like I said, Merciful Fate or Loudness would come over from Japan. And you know, so I guess it was kind of like maybe like Lemours out in you know, the East Coast, but it was just a really cool happening place. So I wish I was there like during the Starwood, because you know, when the first movie, Pioneers of LA Hard Rock and Metal, really focused on the Starwood, because that was the club from like the mid 70s up through 81, and then it closed down. Never quite made it there. The first shows I saw, I remember seeing one of the first times I went to the Whiskey, I believe it might have been the first time I saw Saxon on the Denim and Leather tour in 81 with a Metallica opening, or 82, March of 82. And that was before Metallica, anyone. That was actually Metallica's second show ever.
Yeah.
So
that's a famous in the history books type of show. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Where they opened. Yeah. So what about Gazzaris? We hear a lot about Gazzaris, and I've, as somebody who's, you know, studied a lot of what went on there from a distance, it seems like Gazzaris was kind of like this club that wasn't the hip place to play, but then suddenly at some point it became cool. I know when Van Halen was playing Gazzaris, it was like the place that no one wanted to play. But then many years later, when like Rat and stuff were playing Gazzaris, it suddenly became kind of the hip place. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, you know, Gazzaris was a weird club. That was one of the first venues I went to. I think I went to see August Redmoon when they played out in L.A. because they were buddies of mine, and I drove out there, and I was like 16 and went there, and there was like four different stages. And it was weird because it was a club. It wasn't a big venue. And people have said, I mean, when I interviewed Stephen Piercy, he said there was 12 stages at one point. I don't remember. He might be talking about maybe little go-go stages or something. But I don't remember. I've heard people say there were six or eight. But I think when I was there, there were at least four stages the first time I went there. So it was a real funky setup. It was more of like a hangout, and they had a lot of house bands that would be playing. That, you know, Van Halen became a house band. That was usually the what people don't realize, Mark, is, you know, nowadays really playing the Whiskey or the Roxy, even though Golden Voice owns the Roxy now, so they're just doing pretty much national stuff. But, you know, in the 80s when and 90s and into the 2000s, when you would play these clubs, anyone could play if you had money. It was a pay-to-play thing. So you'd buy the tickets and you would get on the bill. But back then, you had to prove yourself. So Gazzari's was kind of the opening spot. You know, I think Stephen Pearcy talks about how we followed Bill Gazzari around begging him to get, you know, to play, because everyone wanted to play the Sunset Strip. And the Gazzari's right. was always the starting point, you know, because the Whiskey was still doing like national bands or the big headliners, you know, even the local headliners like Smile and Quiet Riot back in the day and, you know, Snow and whatever. So you had to be a pretty big band to play those clubs. It wasn't a matter of, you know, buying tickets or anything. So Gazzari's was a starting point. So you had a lot of more amateurish bands playing at Gazzari's. And, you know, then the house bands, you know, Van Halen was the house band very notorious band that was that really made it from being the house band at Gazzari's. And they say it kind of might have hurt their career, which it probably did, was a band called Shark Island, who were just an amazing band. They used to be called the Sharks. And originally, Richard Black was in a band called Pretty Poison that used to play with Van Halen all the time. I mean, they were like – he goes way back from when he was like 16 or so playing the clubs. But the Sharks, and then they turned into Shark Island. They would play every Friday and Saturday night. And I tell you, all the musicians would flock at midnight. The club would be dead, and then right before midnight, you would see all the guys in Poison. Axl Rose was there religiously. And you know, there's a point where people were saying, oh, Richard was kind of jealous talking about Axl Rose. But the fact is that is absolutely true, because every time I saw Shark Island, I saw Axl Rose in the front of the stage or right by the stage just watching his every move. Yeah, Shark Island, again, was very influential. And, you know, you had the beginnings of Rough Cut and, you know, and they all talk about how it was musical chairs with the bands, like particularly Rough Cut and Rat, you know, and a band called Sarge. They always switched members around and, you know, members flocked from band to band until they kind of found the right chemistry. And that all kind of started happening in the early 80s. And then you had Black and Blue that came down from Oregon that right. made it very quickly. And it was kind of stunning because they were actually one of the first bands to sign with a major. You had Sound Barrier on MCA. And of course, you had A Quiet Riot and Motley. And I think even before Rat and, you know, all those other bands, Black and Blue were one of the first.
Yeah, I always considered them part of that kind of first wave of L.A., you know, metal, hard rock, glammy bands to come out. And the history books don't really reflect that. I mean, we always hear about, of course, Motley Crue and Rat of that first wave. But yeah, Black and Blue was right there. And although they never broke like Motley Crue or Rat, that first album, I got to tell you, is so freaking good.
It is a good album. And their first demo, again, they were really heavy. Their first demo had the demo version of Change Around Heaven was actually on the Metal Massacre.
Yeah, that's right.
Record. And a song called Violent Kid and I'm the King. And they were, again, they were a pretty heavy band. But, you know, I think Brian Slagle, who's interviewed in this movie, says it best. You know, once they sign with the major labels, you know, the labels tried to market them to the MTV and to radio play. So they softened up their sound a bit and kind of honed them into more of this heavy rock pop band. But a lot of those bands were quite heavy back in the day. So, you know, Malice was another band that were really big at the time. You know, they signed with Atlantic early on. And, you know, and then, of course, you can't forget, you know, Megadeth, you know, were based in L.A., you know, and, you know, just so many bands. Racer X was another band we covered extensively that a lot of people neglect to, you know, recall. I mean, Racer X, again, they were packing in just as much or more people than Poison and Warrant. Right. I mean, when Racer X were playing, the clubs, the place was packed. You know, Lizzie Borden and other band that were very huge at the time. Striper were starting out there, and they started out kind of as a Gazzari's band too when they were Rock's Regime. I mean, Striper and Metallica did a show together at a small club called the Bruins Den the Bruins Den in Long Beach. So, you know, it was a different time for sure.
Yeah, man. I mean, you're mentioning all these bands, which again, all hard rock and metal, but definitely different sounds and different styles, from Rat to Armored Saint to Racer X. I mean, this is a diverse group, which I don't know if people always think of the LA metal scene as being diverse, but there was diversity. And kind of on another topic, one thing you get into in the film, again, Inside Metal, the LA metal scene explodes too. It's on Amazon Prime. It's all over the place. We'll have it linked through today's show notes on talkingmetal.com. But one other thing you get into is the stage shows that these bands put on. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they were bringing arena rock style stage shows into the clubs, and they put so much into these stage shows. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the better stage shows you remember, or who were the, I mean, Lizzie Borden, obviously, Wasp. Who else? Well, who were your favorites?
Well, Wasp obviously brought it, because they were doing an arena rock stage show in the Troubadour. And the Troubadour is like about a 400-seat club, although they would stuff like 700 people in. And the first time Wasp played, again, they had the seats. And it wasn't just chairs and tables in the front. They were like those rows of tables that go all the way to the stage. And so you're kind of locked in there. You can't move. And then you have Blackie Lawless, you know, grinding up raw meat and throwing it at the people. They had nowhere to duck or cover because they're sitting down eating dinner, you know, and getting nailed. And it was, back then nobody knew. I mean, it was, you know, long before the whole Great White Fire. And back then, pretty much almost anything went, because I mean, Wasp used to
bring gunpowder and explosives.
Oh yeah,
there's a story in there about Wasp having rats live rats on the stage. This is in the documentary, guys. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what that story is all about and the meat grinder?
Yeah, we talked to both Chris Holmes and Randy Piper. I believe it was Randy Piper that told the rat story, as they were. They had, they were just thinking of anything to get the crowd going and just to, like, you know, build this total raunchy horror kind of show. And they had a meat grinder, as I said, and they had a cage of rats. And apparently they would, like, Blackie would hold the rat up. And he said the way it looked like he put it right in the meat grinder, but it was actually, he was putting it back in the cage, but people couldn't tell. And everyone was saying that he was grinding up the rats and then the meat would just shoot out, you know?
Right.
And people thought it was just hamburger meat, but, you know, it was a big thing. And that, you know, that was, you know, of course, Wasp was notorious. You know, they learned from obviously Kiss and Alice Cooper, probably more so on Alice Cooper with the rat thing, but, you know, that obviously gained them a lot of notoriety. And then, Randy said that all the rats got loose in the Troubadour, and then there was always these reports that people would be at the Troubadour like weeks later and see rats running around and stuff. So, you know, but yeah, they did a lot of crazy stuff. That sign, I mean, you could just feel the heat from the fire on them when they lit up that big sign. I mean, it was insane, that the shows that used to go on, they always put on a great show. There wasn't, obviously, you know, when you got the latter 80s, say what you will about Poison. I was never a Poison fan, but they put on, you know, quite a big show when they did some of the bigger shows out there. Lizzie Borden, as you mentioned, always put on a great show. That was really when the whole, the mix of the denim and leather, all these bands kind of started out with that look, like Rat and Motley. They had, you know, the leather look. And then it slowly, I think Def Leppard had a lot of influence when they were on MTV.
Right.
All the colorful, more glammy kind of clothing. Then you saw Rat kind of dressed like that. And I think, you know, Steven even mentioned he was a real big fan at the time of Duran Duran and Adamant, the way the visual aspect of the way
he says that in the movie. Movie, yeah.
Yeah, and that started getting kind of incorporated into that. So a lot of the it was a weird time because then a lot of the purists, the metal purists, were, ah, this isn't metal. They're, you know. So not just was their music getting lighter, but their stage show was getting a little bit more colorful and glammy. So I think a lot of bands fell trapped to that. Even the heavier bands were kind of doing that. Everyone was doing the big hair from, you know, Lizzie Borden to the Racer X's to even Megadeth, you know, and were had kind of the big hair at one point. So. You know, that look, you know, again, that really carried on more into the latter 80s, but you kind of saw the transition starting at this time. But another thing I want to mention, Marcus, is this was a period where it really introduced the female fronted metal bands, which was very rare. I mean, before that, you had the Runaways. You had, you know, we talked to the Pandoras, we talked to Bitch, we talked to Anne Boleyn of Hellion, Betsy of Bitch, and, you know, before that, there was another band called the Orchids who were around the time that, you know, they played the Starwood, but that was it. They were more poppy, but here you had Betsy Bitch, who was this clad S&M leather, you know, chick on stage. And that was the first time you ever saw that, not just in LA, but really anywhere, of a female coming out doing that. And totally. Anne Boleyn had this very Dio-esque type of voice. And, you know, she didn't sound like a typical chick singer. So, you know, that's another thing we got to give credit to, that, you know, when they first started, people, it was like, this is a man's game, man. No women allowed. But, you know, they really opened up a lot of doors for a lot of the female bands that, especially the metal bands and the female fronted metal bands. So, want to give props to them.
Oh, absolutely.
And of course, people like Gina Zamparelli, who was, you know, one of the first women to come out as a promoter. Again, it was always a man's game, especially when it came to hard rock and metal doing promotions. Right. And that's another topic we get into as well.
Yeah, it's a great documentary, and I highly recommend everyone check this out. One other thing I would really have to give you props for putting out there, which I think is such an important point. And it's, you know, the history books have been written a certain way. And I really think the way they've been written is wrong. And you shed light on the truth of this myth in your documentary. And the myth to me, and I've always believed that it's a myth, is that one day MTV played Smells Like Teen Spirit and all the hard rock bands out of LA and that genre, you know, died. And I think it's great that you have Don Dokken and Stephen Piercy and other people talking about how grunge didn't kill this scene. This maybe the scene killed itself. Maybe it was the oversaturation. Maybe it was the business record companies just putting too much of it down our throats that we needed something else. And maybe it was just, you know, the uniqueness and the excitement was lost, and another thing kind of came in and took our excitement away from the LA metal scene. What is your personal thoughts on grunge killing the LA metal scene?
Well, yeah, what they state is absolutely true. I think Mike Stone, who was in Eden at the time, of course, he later joined Queensryche as a guitar player, but the guy, I actually managed him with Eden. He's an unbelievable singer. Right. I think he touched on that, how, and of course, Stephen Piercy talked about that too. We didn't want to get too much into the whole grunge thing because that happened a little bit later. We tried to keep it at 86, but it was something that was starting. And the whole thing, what they talk about, it became this cookie cutter mentality after a while. Once the band started getting signed, you know, in the beginning, it was very organic. You know, even Motley Rat and all those bands, they didn't have anyone to look up to except, you know, maybe the British bands or Van Halen, but they were kind of doing their own kind of thing. And then everybody, MTV happened, the visuals came out, everyone in the later 80s, you know, 88, 89, boom, they were coming to LA. They all looked the same. They all dressed the same. They all sounded the same. And that, honestly, it got ridiculous. It got stupid. Not to say there weren't good bands,
right?
But just it was a cookie cutter mentality. And at that point, a lot of the labels were just signing up crap, and you know, some good, some bad. Some of them were just generic, and I think people saw right through it. So there is definitely some truth about it, but it really was the bands that really kind of killed the scene. It was and I think that happens with anything, whether it be disco or whatever. There's a point of oversaturation, or where it becomes silly. You know, when Rick Dees is doing the disco duck, it's like, all right, time to officially kill disco now, you know? So, and I think that happens with any genre. Punk, I mean, punk killed itself in the same way. Punk was supposed to be this anarchist underground thing. We hate commercial anti-rock stars. And then you had Billy Idol and Adam Ant and The Clash, you know, becoming these huge pop sensations on MTV, you know, and becoming what they supposedly despise, these arena gigantic bands, you know? So, you know, kind of the same thing, you know, and I think that's really what happened. And I think a lot of the metal bands after the 90s hit, you heard it. They were trying to get more grunge or more gritty and this and that. And it didn't work for a lot of them. And right. I think, you know, you can't blame grunge. You could blame, I mean, the way the industry did it, it was just like, boom, right there. And it was just this overturning and not just the labels, but everything, press, all these people. You never got the thing about heavy metal, no matter how popular the bands were, Rat, Motley and whatever, they never got the exposure that either the punk or the grunge bands did.
Right.
And everyone says how grunge and all that was underground. When Nirvana hit, Pearl Jam hit, they were all over Rolling Stone, all the magazines, all the radio stations constantly playing them on alternative stations, rock stations, major oversaturation. Rat and Motley, they never got that. They still hate – people still kind of hated that metal. You had the PMRC, which was a huge thing come out of this. You know, it was still an anti-metal thing, and it was really more underground that really brought it up. It was – you know, people say that MTV broke metal, and I say no. Metal broke MTV. You know, there were bands – you know, Metallica did 3 albums selling triple platinum – you know, with Master of Puppets, or at least double platinum at the time.
With no music videos.
Absolutely. So it was metal that helped MTV. It wasn't, you know, MTV. Metal would have survived without MTV. You know, might not have been to that level, that commercial level, but it absolutely would have survived. I mean, look at Van Halen and all these bands survived, you know, forever without MTV. I don't think the new wave scene or the grunge scene would have survived so much without MTV. Metal would have. So, you know, that I will say, but as far as what you're saying is, it is absolutely true that the bands killed themselves. It was really the fault of the oversaturation, and the bands were willing to not take any chances. The labels were really unwilling to take chances. You know, it's funny because the labels really had a lot to do with it, Mark. I mean,
yeah, I think they were so responsible for it, because I remember I was probably like, you know, 18, 19 at the time, and that's when Warrant came out. And I like Warrant now, but when Warrant came out, I was kind of like, eh, this has been done before. You know, Firehouse, I was like, this is boring. This has been done before. And I, as a consumer of this stuff, started looking elsewhere. Suddenly I was like, oh, Living Color, what's this? You know, Alice in Chains, what's this? Even stuff like Fishbone I was getting into at that point, because I had grown not tired of Motley Crue and Rat, but I had grown tired of their offspring, what they had spawned, you know, like the Firehouse and Warrant. Again, nowadays I've gone back and now I appreciate Warrant, but at the time I was not ready to listen to them, you know, and I think it's the labels just really oversaturated things.
Absolutely. And, you know, Mark, I was the same way. I mean, when the Soundgarden, especially when the Loud Love album came out, I just was all over that. I saw them at the clubs, at the Whiskey, and at a place called Hollywood Live. I saw them at Jezebel's, open for Prong and Voivod, and they were just amazing. And so many of those bands, Alice in Chains, as you say. It was something definitely fresh and exciting. So, I forgot the point that you were so about the labels. But the labels are such hypocrites, these A&R guys, because they were the ones telling these bands to sound like this, look like this. This is what sells. This is what's on MTV. And then, boom, it was like overnight. The labels are saying, we're all about grunge. It's the grunge is happening. All these glam bands, that's not real. That's all this and that. It's like, dude, you were the guys telling these bands how to look.
Yeah,
how
good to point.
Sound, you know, and so yeah, the labels were. I mean, of course, it's a business to them, so they're gonna flock. You know, I mean, Janie Lane talks about, you know, how one day he was at the record company, saw the big warrant poster behind the president's desk, that's and then right. The next day it was like Alice in Chains or something like that. And,
right.
But that's how it was. It was kind of like, forget this totally. We're onto this now.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought was stupid. It was just kind of like, okay, this is dead. And it was not just the labels, but the press and everything. It's like, okay, we're going to kill it. But the fact is, a lot of these bands lived on. And then you even had bands in the 90s. You know, a perfect example is Jackal. When they came out, everyone thought they were a joke. And I thought that was great because that was so refreshing after hearing Pearl Jam just saturated all over the place. Nirvana saturated. Here comes a band that's got that Southern rock, that old, you know, like Black Oak, Arkansas meets Blackfoot meets Motorhead attitude.
Yeah.
And just ripping it up. And it's like, yes, thank God, you know, long hair, just rock, dirty, you know, that album went, I know, at least platinum, maybe double platinum. So the fans were still there. I mean, all these places, everyone says that the 90s were dead. I lived in LA in the 90s and all through the mid to late 90s, you know, you had the Cat House in the early 90s, the Thunderdome, Exposure 54, all these clubs still in the 90s. So it was still like grunge was going on and it was powerful, but metal was still big. But I think everyone just tried to, like, you know, put it down. And then, you know, she had thrash metal. That was always huge. You know, it never died. So, you're absolutely right, Mark.
So the third movie that I'm told is coming, when is the third movie coming? Next year?
Well, we're editing it now. It's called Rise of LA Thrash Metal. And basically when we did this, all the interviews were conducted about two and a half, maybe 3 years ago now.
Yeah.
And they were all we just did an onslaught of interviews. And then we kind of decided, Joe and Carl and I, let's cut it up into these three movies, you know, because we did that in the time frame. And then we wanted to do something on the LA thrash scene, because I particularly think a lot of the LA thrash bands, again, which was a huge movement, was totally underlooked, because the glam rock and the hair metal, as they call it, hair metal, became so popular. And then, of course, Metallica moved to the Bay Area, and then the thrash scene, everything was concentrated on the Bay Area. And then you had, you know, a lot of great bands, you know, Testament and Exodus and Death Angel coming out of there. So it was something that was really ignored, and I thought it was important for us to tell the real story. So we touch on, of course, Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, of course. And we also talk about, you know, Agent Steel, Dark Angel, Suicidal Tendencies, of course, Hyrax, Overkill LA, who are also in this, the LA metal scene explodes.
Yes.
Overkill LA were before Overkill New Jersey, and they were on, I believe, the second Metal Massacre record, and they were a pretty big punk metal band. And so what we get into all these, I even interviewed, we used some segments for the Weasels, who I thought were really the first crossover a punk metal band that I saw long before Suicidal. We're talking early 70s. I mean, they used to play with AC/DC at the Whiskey, AC/DC and Van Halen, and they had a song. I mean, it's funny. They would have been banned now or just been thrown in jail or whatever, but the song was called Beat Her With a Rake. Right. Beat Her With a Rake and Make Her Pay For Her Mistake. And we covered that in the first movie as well. But they were really, I think, the first punk metal band that really kind of had that crossover. So, you know, we get into a lot of those bands, and I think it's important to touch on, because these bands were kind of, they were all banned from Hollywood, so they were playing, as I mentioned, a lot of the Orange County clubs, or even like the Balboa Theater, which was in Watts, which is like, I guess, the equivalent of Harlem and you know, and just these ghetto areas, Long Beach Fenders Ballroom, the Olympic Auditorium, where a lot of the punk bands played. So these thrash bands were playing there, and they were getting, you know, thousands of people in these venues, but it was just kind of overlooked. So again, I wanted to really give props to a lot of these bands that were overlooked, whether it be bands from the 70s like a Legs Diamond or even London, who've been around forever, to the thrash bands, you know, Agent Steel and you know, Suicide, although Suicidal can kind of make up a Dark Angel, and you know, a lot of these bands that really kind of were the forefront of thrash, and just as important as the Bay Area metal scene. But just so the Bay Area people don't get pissed off, we are doing our fourth title, which I've already finished all the interviews for, is going to be on the Bay Area metal scene, inside metal, the Bay Area. And that's going to cover the whole Bay Area thrash scene, as well as a lot of the other bands from the Bay Area. People forgot that there are a lot of great, you know, just regular rock bands and even glam bands like Vane, Davey Vane. Right. You know, of course, Jet Boy was from there, Lost Rocket, and, you know, a lot of just more mainstream kind of bands, Head On. So we kind of mix it up, and that's going to be a real good one too, because they talk a lot about how the, you know, the thrash and the glam kind of melded together in the Bay Area, which was a whole separate scene than LA. So it's exciting. I love working on this. It's a lot of fun, and it's just really, you know, it's a blast from the past, and it's great interviewing these bands and talking for hours with these guys and sharing old stories. And, you know, I wish I could share some of the stories that when the cameras weren't rolling. Yeah, there's some great stuff, but yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Cool. Well, Bob, again, thanks for doing this great movie. The LA metal scene explodes. It's Inside Metal. Do we call it part two? Is that?
Yeah, it's the second title. So right. It would be a part two, but it, so people do know it is a two part DVD and movie. If you do it digitally, a lot of people just saw the first one, you know, volume one, and they said, dude, you left out so many bands and this and that. Like, well, watch volume two as well.
Right. Right.
You'll see. So both of them are two volume. It looks like the Rise of LA Thrash Metal, as well as the San Francisco one, will be two volume as well. I know it's confusing, and it wasn't intentional. We just had so much material. And, you know, Warren, who's been very supportive, the executive producer, he's, you know, let us do it, you know, our way. And he said, you know what, dude, just make it two volumes. So rather than leaving stuff out and making it not flow, we decided, it makes sense. Let's do two volumes.
Cool. Right on. Well, it's always great talking with you, and thanks for coming back and checking in with us on Talking Metal. When the next volume comes out, or the next episode or DVD 3, you know, the thrash metal one, please come back and we'll talk again.
I would love to. I appreciate all your support, Mark. Thank you.
Cool. Keep in touch, Bob.
You got it, man. Bye-bye.
Have a good night.